This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, John Sweeney, has been credited with revitalizing the labor movement. Last October, he was voted president of the AFL-CIO. He was the opposition candidate, promising to make the union movement more aggressive. His opponent, Thomas Donohue, had become interim president just a few months before the election, after longtime President Lane Kirkland retired rather than face strong opposition. John Sweeney is the former president of the Service Employees International Union. During his tenure, the union nearly doubled in size at a time when membership in the AFL-CIO was declining. Sweeney has a new book called America Needs a Raise. He spoke at the Democratic Convention and campaigned with President Clinton on Labor Day. I asked Sweeney how comfortable labor is with Clinton.
Well, I think that we're very comfortable with President Clinton. We did not take the endorsement process lightly. We did it after reaching out to our members in polls and surveys, and not just within the AFL-CIO, but within individual unions. And we were confident that our members supported an endorsement for the president. But we also recognized that we had differences with the president. At the time we endorsed, probably the most important difference was over NAFTA. Since then, we've had our differences over welfare reform. But basically, the president is viewed by our members as a pro-worker president, as one who has tried to address those issues, but unfortunately has run into some problems with the Congress in terms of those issues. And I think that the president is committed to addressing the issues of America's working families, and that he's comfortable with the labor movement. I saw him on Labor Day when he appeared at two large workers' rallies in two different cities, in Green Bay and Milwaukee, and the welcome that he received from families in those areas was just so impressive.
The more conservative wing of the Democratic Party is trying to head in the opposite direction than you want the party to head in. What are you trying to do to influence the party from inside?
Well, if you just look at the number of delegates to the Democratic National Convention who were union members, and I'm including all the AFL-CIO unions as well as the National Education Association, there were approximately 1,200 to 1,300 delegates who were union members. This is about a fourth of all the delegates. That shows an interest at the grassroots level in politics. What we're doing in terms of our politics is participating in the process more aggressively and independently. But we're using television and radio to raise the issues of concerns of working people. We're sending organizers to congressional districts to mobilize grassroots activists and members who are interested in politics. We're asking them to volunteer some time to taking the message, a message of economic justice, to their fellow workers, to their neighbors, to their community leaders, and we're also encouraging them to do letter writing campaigns and to hold meetings. Politicians to be responsible, and we want to hold them accountable on issues that affect America's working families.
Your mission is in part to address people within the Democratic Party. In other words, to address Democratic candidates and Democratic congressmen and have them be more sympathetic to your issues?
I wish that there were more Republicans. In the past, we've had greater support from Republicans on these issues, but over the past couple of years, we've seen a complete turnaround. This is a bipartisan effort. I went to the Republican convention. I was not invited into it, but I held a rally of workers in the San Diego area who had asked me to come. We had a number, not too big a number, but we had some delegates who were union members, and we recognized that probably 20 to 25% of our members are registered Republicans. It's not about party politics. It's not about candidates of either party. It's about electing candidates who will support solutions to workers' problems and holding these candidates accountable.
Yeah, in 1994, according to the New York Times, 40% of voters from union households voted Republican in the congressional elections. Some people assume that the labor vote is a Democratic vote. What does the 40% say?
Well, I think we saw in 1994, I don't agree that it was as high as 40%, but it was probably close to it. The 40% poll was done by Newt Gingrich's pollster. But the bottom line is that the working Americans rebelled against the establishment. They were voting their own frustrations with their own lives and their own consideration of where candidates were and what was happening inside the Beltway. But they weren't voting to see Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid under attack or reductions made in their educational programs, environment, safety, and health. I mean, they were voting out of their own frustration. And what they saw happen after that really, I think, turned them around. And I think we're going to see a change in Congress in November.
What are you saying that they saw that turned them around?
They saw the attacks on programs that they felt were necessary to them and to their families, broad programs that crossed the bounds of organized labor and unorganized, middle income, middle management, the Medicare attacks, the opposition to the minimum wage. I mean, Time magazine had a poll where I think close to 80% of the American people supported an increase in minimum wage, not because of the effect on their own lives, but out of a sense of fairness. Bob Dole had an opportunity before he left the Senate to bring the minimum wage up for a vote, and he refused to do it. They talk all the rhetoric, but they're not out there championing the solutions to the problems.
How has the global economy affected unions? In many cases, now an industry has consolidated to a few large multinationals. So instead of thousands or hundreds of small companies, in some industries, you're basically dealing with a couple of really big ones. So how does that change your tactics?
Well, I think you have to look at the broader picture in terms of our economy. I really think that many of the problems that workers have today is basically that corporate America responded to the global economy in the wrong way. They chose not to compete in the old-fashioned way with American know-how and American teamwork. Instead, I'm sorry to say, they chose to compete by driving labor costs, downsizing their workforce, freezing their pay, cutting health care, cutting other benefits as well, raiding their pensions, moving jobs to low-wage labor markets overseas. I believe that they're taking the low road. And in the long run, that leads to a less prosperous, more polarized America, and not a more competitive America. I think that we have to have a resuming of corporate responsibility, the social contract that we had in early years in terms of labor and management and government working together. We all recognize that we have to really strive for growth in our economy and face up to all of the challenges, but we also have to have respect for workers and respect for human dignity.
John Sweeney is my guest. He's the new head of the AFL-CIO. He was elected last October. Now he has a new book called America Needs a Raise. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with John Sweeney, who was elected the head of the AFL-CIO last October. He has a new book now called America Needs a Raise. John Sweeney, I'd like to talk a little bit about your labor background. I know your father was a bus driver. He was a union man, belonged to the Transport Workers Union. What were your father's thoughts about the union?
My father was a good member of the Transport Workers Union. He had no ambitions for elected office or political office, but he was a member who enjoyed going to union meetings, who was very much interested in their bargaining and in their politics and so on, all the activities of the union. And he represented the best of trade unionism in terms of my own life. And I remember the days of him going out on strike to achieve a 40-hour work week when they were working 48 and 50 hours. I remember how pleased he would be with successful contract negotiations when his vacation was improved and affording him the opportunity to spend much more time with us. It's a very happy memory, and that's the kind of family environment that I grew up in.
What are your memories of the times when your father was on strike and there was no money coming in?
Well, there were tough times, my mother was a domestic worker, and she would go out doing domestic work to try and make ends meet. But he understood why they had to go on strike, and he understood what was at stake, and they weren't exorbitant demands. They were just demands that were necessary in order to keep up with the standard of living and improve dignity on the job and have a better life for his family.
Now, I'm sure your mother was not unionized. If she were working today, is there a union she could belong to as a domestic worker?
Well, there are different jobs related to domestic work that have been organized. Some of the work that's done in hotels, a lot of the home health care work is similar in some regards, although the level of skill has been increased. When in my earlier days, when I was in New York, I had a goal to try and organize domestic workers, but it was very difficult. And I thought that since we represented the doormen and women in apartment buildings in New York City, that we would be able to impress on our rank and file members the need to organize domestic workers. However, it was very difficult because of the different work situations with domestic workers, but it led us to domestic workers who were moving into home health care at a time when that was expanding back in the late 60s and early 70s. And today we have in New York City alone well over 30,000 home health care workers who go into elderly and disabled people's homes to help them and assist them. And this program has spread across the country.
Tell me a little bit more about why it was so difficult when you started the campaign to organize domestic workers.
Well, they work part-time. They work for many different employers. Do not have to come to any common meeting place or any place where you would have an opportunity to address them on their issues and talk to them about what their problems were related to their jobs. Inability to communicate and directly with them is probably the biggest obstacle.
What was your first strike?
Actually, my first strike was I was a caddy as a kid.
A golf caddy?
Yes, freshman in high school. And we decided one Saturday in June or July, I forget, that we were not going to go out that day with the golfers unless we got an increase. And we were getting less than $2 to carry a golf bag for 18 holes, and we all thought that there should be some improvement. And so we stayed outside the golf course on the Saturday morning, and the golf course was set up on the top of a hill in Yonkers, New York, and we'd normally be waiting for the golfers to come and get a ride up the hill with them. But this particular morning, we refused the rides, and a couple of hours went by around 10 o'clock in the morning. A committee of the golfers came down and wanted to know what was the gripe, and we told them that we wanted an increase. And they went back up and talked to the other members and other golfers, and then came back to us, and we ended up with a 75-cent increase per bag, and that was a real great increase in those days, and that was my first strike.
Did you think if you lost, you never would have become a union organizer?
No, I think we were convinced that their anxiety to get out on the golf course was the right time to go for an increase. And I think it was also a recognition on their part that we deserved an increase.
You're credited with helping to reinvigorate the labor movement. When did you realize that the union movement was declining?
I guess over the period of time, as I moved more into my own position as president of the Service Employees Union and took on new programs and initiated some new strategies in terms of organizing and outreach and working together with other unions who were realizing that it was time for a change. We were a part of the leadership of the labor movement for a number of years, and no one individual or no couple of individuals can be blamed, if that's the proper word, for us not addressing the issues of change. But I think we all came to a realization that we had to reverse the trend of decline in membership, that we had to strengthen the political voice of our members, that we had to improve the perception of the labor movement, both inside the labor movement as well as outside. And that all happened or came to a head, really, over the course of the last 2 years. And I think you're seeing that going on right now.
Some labor leaders have also been great orators who, move large crowds through the power of their ability to speak in public. Many people have pointed out that you're a very low-key personality as a public figure, that, oration is not the greatest gift that you bring to your position as president of the AFL-CIO. I'm wondering if you feel that has ever held you back or if you've done other things to compensate for not being the fiery speaker.
Well, I believe that you you use the talents that you have to the best of your ability, and you also realize that you have to reach out to others who have stronger talents in some areas and complement what you're trying to achieve. And I think we're doing just that. Well, if you look at the three top officers of the AFL-CIO now, we're as different as day and night, and yet we complement each other and are working together with the leadership of the Executive Council of the AFL-CIO with many different talents there as well, and using the strengths that we have where it is important to use different individuals, and recognizing this is not any kind of a limited show. This is about a movement, building a movement that that truly represents every single rank and file worker out there, and I think we're moving in that direction.
I have one last question for you.
Sure.
What do you see ahead in the immediate future for the AFL? What's the most immediate change in tactic that you expect to see?
I think you see a lot of different things, but probably the three most important are our stronger political voice in this campaign and in these elections. But while we're doing that for the short term, we're also building a political network, hopefully for the longer term, that will involve our membership all across the country. At the same time, we're developing a more aggressive organizing program. Our goal is to train 1,000 new organizers over the course of the next year and a half, to put more resources into organizing. The Federation does not do the organizing, the individual unions do, but we can be helpful in bringing coordinated organizing together in terms of the training and assessing of opportunities. And with all of this, reaching out to women and to young workers and to civil rights activists and minorities and religious leaders. We're building a coalition that I think is going to be effective in all of the major areas. And our hope is that we're changing or improving the perception of the labor movement and really relating it more and more directly to rank and file workers all across the country.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you very much.
John Sweeney is the president of the AFL-CIO. His new book is called America Needs a Raise. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.